From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross, who's on assignment today. On the outskirts of Denver, Colorado, there's a lake where the nearby U.S. Army base has dumped toxins for decades. Science writer Seth Shulman says there are many more examples of toxic dumping near military bases across the country. Today on Fresh Air, the toxic legacy of the U.S. military. Also, we meet performance artist Rodessa Jones. Her theater piece, Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women, is based on the women inmates she met when she tried to launch an aerobics program at a city jail. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by the multifaceted Hal Russell. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. After 4 days of violent clashes between troops and demonstrators calling for democratic reform in Thailand, Thai television broadcast live a meeting between the King of Thailand, the non-elected Prime Minister Suchinda, and the man who has led mass protests against him. From Bangkok, the BBC's Alexander Thompson has more.
It was an extraordinary meeting with the King sitting on a sofa in his living room, speaking to two men who've been sworn enemies and whose supporters have brought Thailand to the brink of catastrophe. General Suchinda in a lounge suit and Chumlong Simawang in a simple peasant's shirt sat on the carpeted floor listening respectfully to the words of the King, who is a revered figure in this country. The King spoke of the need for peace and reconciliation and asked the two men to resolve their differences in a peaceful parliamentary way for the sake of the nation. General Suchinda and Chumlong Simawang, sitting side by side, then called for an end to all protests and demonstrations, and General Suchinda said all those detained during the unrest, including Chumlong Simawang, would be set free.
Alexander Thompson reporting. The Senate has passed legislation aimed at the 70 million Americans who are eligible to vote but are not registered. The measure would make it simpler for them to register, but it faces a certain veto by President Bush, who claims it will encourage election fraud. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The Senate passed the long-stalled legislation by a vote of 61 to 38. The vote came after Democrats finally broke a Republican filibuster, which has blocked the measure for several years, despite its passage in the House. Under the bill, Americans could automatically register to vote when they apply for or renew their driver's licenses, or if they apply for welfare, unemployment compensation, or disability benefits. Democrat Dale Bumpers of Arkansas says it's a first step toward getting Americans involved again in their government.
The Constitution provides endless rights. And I tell every graduating class I speak to, you also have responsibilities.
President Bush, who has threatened to veto the bill, and Senate Republicans argue that it opens up the process to fraud. They fear officials at government agencies will coerce applicants into signing up for a particular party or backing a specific candidate. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
A federal appeals court has refused to block Roger Keith Coleman's execution tonight for the rape and murder of his sister-in-law. Earlier today, Coleman failed a lie detector test he was permitted to take by Virginia Governor Doug Wilder. Coleman is scheduled to die in Virginia's electric chair just after 11 o'clock Eastern Time. Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 4 points to close at 3393.84. Declines edged out advances after heavy trading of 198 million shares. This is NPR. Authorities in Rochester, Michigan say a two-story building was leveled this afternoon in a natural gas explosion that left one dead and at least six other people injured. The blast, about 5:15 p.m., destroyed a travel service. Rochester is about 30 miles north of Detroit. Police have cordoned off the area. There was no fire after the blast, but firefighters are still at the scene. Vice President Dan Quayle was in Los Angeles today answering the questions of eighth graders at a middle school in South Central Los Angeles. A number of those asking the questions said Quayle's answers show a lack of understanding of inner-city problems. Kitty Feldy of station KLON reports.
Vice President Quayle told a library full of eighth graders that education is a federal priority, but federal funding to schools like theirs is unlikely to rise above the current 8% level. One girl asked what the Bush administration would do for a young black male on welfare trying to finish school.
I would hope that he would have the attitude that I can do it, if I stick to it, if I stay in school, finish school, stay off of drugs, stay away from crime.
But the vice president's answers sounded like campaign rhetoric to eighth grader Samantha Nash.
Quayle was saying what all the answers were, the same thing over and over and over again, but in different words.
The vice president repeated his call for parental choice in school selection and said the rule for his children is absolutely no television on weekdays. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
Salomon Brothers will pay $290 million to settle fraud charges stemming from last year's Treasury bond auction scandal. The settlement is one of the biggest ever paid for wrongdoing in the securities industry. No criminal charges will be levied against Salomon Brothers. The firm admitted last year to improper bidding practices. It said it placed unauthorized bids and bought more notes than legally allowed to at federal Treasury auctions. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. With the end of the Cold War, U.S. military sites across the country and around the world are being closed. One of the legacies of that era is toxic waste production and dumping from military installations. Seth Shulman has been investigating the practices and attitudes of the military towards the environment for 4 years. He found through visits to military sites and from reports obtained through the Freedom of Information Act that the military has been allowed to operate outside environmental laws and has created a serious environmental problem. In this country, more than 20,000 sites are suspected of being contaminated. The cost of cleanup is estimated to run into the hundreds of billions of dollars. Shulman's book is called The Threat at Home, Confronting the Toxic Legacy of the U.S. Military. Shulman's introduction to the seriousness of this problem began with a visit to the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, which is located outside Denver, Colorado. On the site are a number of holding basins containing toxic waste. The contents of basins A through E have been absorbed into the ground. I asked him to describe basin F.
Basin F sits on a parcel of land that's 26 square miles. It's on the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, which is an Army facility. And this is a facility where they produced chemical weapons and disposed of the byproducts of that production dating back to World War II. And during my tour of the facility, I was driven along a road in the center of the Rocky Mountain Arsenal where we went by on the right-hand side a series of dug-out, burnt-out pieces of land. And finally, across the road, we came to Basin F. They were lettered, Basin A, Basin B. These were pits, lagoons that they had dug over the years to dispose of the byproducts of mustard gas and nerve gas that they produced at the facility. And only the most recent one, Basin F, had been lined with asphalt. So by the time we got there, Basin F still contained its contents, which were a green, phosphorescent, slightly glowing, concentrated toxic sludge. It was quite a disturbing sight, a lagoon, something on the order of 93 acres, basically a toxic lake.
Is there a cleanup on the books?
Well, again, you're talking about a site that many experts have called the most toxic square mile on Earth. There is a lot of debate about what to do about it. Since my visit, Basin F has been dredged into holding tanks, and some of the dirt underneath the other lagoons I was speaking of has been piled into a mound on the facility. But this is just a prelude to a real cleanup. They think just this one site alone, a cleanup will cost on the order of $1 billion or possibly even more. This is an awful lot of money to spend, of course, and so it's not an easy answer. We have a lot of work yet to be done at this site, and this is one of the most one of the furthest along.
What are the toxic hazardous materials that are produced on a military base? And here I'm talking very generally, looking at military bases across the country.
Let's take just a simple example by way of trying to answer your question. The Pentagon buys roughly 200 million barrels of fuel oil a year. 200 million barrels. by my calculations, this is a stream of barrels that could wrap around the Earth five times. Enough oil, according to one estimate, to run the entire public transit system for more than a decade. This is a big, big enterprise. That's just oil use. Similarly, the military uses almost every kind of chemical. The Air Force Logistics Branch maintains some 53,000 jet engines. That's a huge fleet of engines. These engines, to maintain them, they use a lot of solvents to clean them off for maintenance purposes. The Army makes a huge amount of munitions. They make bombs and artillery shells, and in the production of virtually all of this ammunition, there are toxic byproducts. In fact, every Army ammunition plant in the country has polluted its land, and in many, many cases, the local groundwater as well.
Well, taken as a whole, then, looking at all the military bases, all the military installations, and then comparing that to industry, who's the worst offender?
Well, that's a really tough question. I've worked on that for a long time. You see a lot of different estimates, and as a journalist, it's tricky to pick your way through them. One thing that you see an awful lot is that the military's generation of toxic waste is greater than the top five multinational chemical companies combined. I was unable to definitively establish that. What I can tell you, though, is that the military produces something on the order of a ton of toxic waste every minute, and that no matter how you look at it, we're talking about one of the world's largest generators of toxics.
Now, why don't the environmental laws that apply to the civilian sector, the private sector, apply to military installations?
Well, to a large extent, we have seen, since World War II, we've seen the military be able to insulate itself from the environmental laws that came on the books. Now, it's the more I've looked into it, the trickier it becomes in some respects. We saw in 1976, President Carter issued an executive order that said, in essence, that all federal facilities, including military facilities, would be bound by the same laws that private industry was bound by. Unfortunately, though, we never saw the kind of enforcement. And during the Reagan years, Reagan issued a different executive order that hampered the Environmental Protection's ability to enforce the law against another branch of the government, basically tied their hands. So without that enforcement, without that kind of oversight or accountability by a separate agency, we've seen the Pentagon, all the branches of the armed forces, essentially able to just hide behind the fences of their facility, maintain that they're responsible for the own mess that they're making, and also hide behind a veil of national security, maintaining that a lot of what they do for security reasons was secret, and denying access to people concerned about the environment, denying access to people, for instance, from the Environmental Protection Agency.
Much of the information in your book you obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. You mentioned the fact that a lot of this information is secret, and a lot of these sites are fenced up and people cannot get into them. Are you saying that the military is really covering up their toxic waste, or do they truly consider this material not hazardous, or not as hazardous as others might?
Well, let me first say that over the 4.5 years that I worked on this project, I've seen a dramatic change in the way the military views the problem. We've yet to see a lot of cleanup, but we are seeing a major change in the way that the problem is addressed. We went through a period of some 15 years or so, from the middle 1970s through the 1980s, where the private sector was ramping up, following a lot of the environmental laws that were coming onto the books. And meanwhile, right next door, the military was doing nothing of the kind. And in fact, during this time, there are dozens and dozens of cases where the military, when it discovered the extent of its problem, did try to cover it up, even when people on the base realized that contaminants in high numbers were threatening neighboring communities. We have a number of cases like that, and some of them I look at quite closely in the book. I hope that most of that is behind us now, and I can't say with any assurance that it is, but I will say that I think probably a lot of that active secrecy to cover up the extent of the problem is behind us. And one of the reasons is that for the past 5 years or so, the Pentagon has been in a counting mode. They've been counting up how many sites they have, how bad the problem is. And as that information has begun to seep out to the public, some of the worst and most embarrassing facts about the situation have come forth, and it makes the need to cover up the information evaporate. Of course, also the end of the Cold War helps in this regard also to open it up.
I have a letter here from Thomas E. Baca, who's the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, and this is a letter about your book. He says that 7,000 of the sites that were cited in your book have been closed out, that their current environmental programs are making positive changes, which he says are too numerous to go in at this time in this particular letter. Does this really underscore what you're saying, which is that the Pentagon or the Defense Department is taking this issue seriously and taking steps to fix the problem?
Well, I have a lot of respect for Mr. Baca, but the section of the letter responding to my book that you just read is in error, basically. It's complicated. Let me try and explain it to you as I understand it. Over the past number of years, every year the Pentagon issues a list, an annual report of the Defense and Environmental Restoration Program, which gives a status report of how they're doing. Since I wrote the book, the very latest report has come out. Now, the report and most all of the information in my book rely completely, of course, on the military's own estimation of the problem. There is no other source. But this year, for the first time, they've begun to introduce this new category, which is called, if you notice what he said some 7,000 sites have been closed out.
Right.
It doesn't say cleaned up, it says closed out. If you look at the latest report, those 7,000 sites, by the way, have miraculously been closed out since the time my book was published. Actually, if you look at the very latest figures that he's drawing upon, we see that 372 remedial actions have been completed. 372. This is out of 17,660 sites that the military's investigated. It works out to being something on the order of 2%, which is what I said based on last year's figure.
Let me make sure I understand the language here, though. You're saying the word remedial actions. Does that mean actually
cleanup? It can be anything from moving a bunch of barrels off of a site to setting up a water treatment facility. It can be a relatively minimal thing, or sometimes a relatively major thing. But only 372 have actually been completed to date. Only somewhat more than that are even underway at this point. Mostly what we've been seeing is what they call preliminary assessments and site investigations, where the military and its contractors go in to try and assess just how bad the problem is. And on the basis of that, sometimes the determination is made to put off the cleanup, or that a cleanup can wait or is not needed. And this they call now closing out a site. It means they're not going to do anything about it. Of course, in the absence of the kind of oversight and accountability that I'm talking about, I have a lot of concern about these 7,000 sites. Again, regardless, we're talking about tens of thousands of sites that, even by the military's own estimation today, need a cleanup, that they plan ultimately to clean up, but that they, you know, compare that number well over 10,000 to the 372 that have actually been addressed.
My guest today on Fresh Air is Seth Shulman, and his book is called The Threat at Home, and it's actually a study of the U.S. military's toxic environmental legacy. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with writer Seth Shulman about his book called The Threat at Home, Confronting the Toxic Legacy of the U.S. Military. When talking about cleaning up toxic lakes, toxic runoffs, is this a solvable problem beyond putting in cement pools? Looking at today's technology, is it possible to truly clean up a toxic waste site?
The truth is, we're dealing with a military that is no stranger to technological wizardry when it comes to all sorts of endeavors, designing guided missiles that can hit very precise targets, you name it. But more than the technological side is the will and the public will and commitment to do the job. There certainly are some sites where the tremendous cost of cleaning up a relatively remote facility is going to present us with a very difficult set of choices. And of course, the contamination and the cleanup are all going to be paid for with taxpayer funds.
So, but there is some technology. There's some talk about bacteria that actually eat toxins, using robots, sending them out, I guess, into some of these areas and using them to clean up toxic waste, vacuum extraction. Is this all kind of pie in the sky stuff, or is this something with a will and with the money that could actually be used to clean up these toxic sites?
Well, all the techniques you've mentioned have some potential, with the exception of the bacteria eating the bioremediation, which is still a bit of a question mark, even though there's some pilot projects out there. But again, to my way of thinking, the technological problem is not the largest one here. I do discuss it to some degree in the book, but let me give you an example. One place I visited, and I discuss it in the book early on, is called the Jefferson Proving Ground. This is a 100-square-mile facility in southeastern Indiana, where since World War II, the Army has tested the vast majority of its chemical munitions, bombs, artillery shells, mines. Essentially what you have there now, after some 50 years of testing, is a 100-square-mile minefield. By the Army's estimation, they're not really sure, but there are anywhere between 1.5 and 7.5 million unexploded bombs and shells lying buried underneath the ground of the Jefferson Proving Ground. Now, the cleanup of such a site is going to be astronomically expensive. Some of these bombs and shells and mines are buried to a depth of some 30 feet below the ground. To clean this facility up, what they'd have to do is get armored vehicles and essentially strip mine the place down to a depth of some 30 feet. Can they do it? Well, theoretically, yes. It would probably cost billions of dollars to do that job. Will they do it? I think there's very little chance in the foreseeable future that that cleanup will be undertaken. What we see in the case of Jefferson Proving Ground is a base that's now slated to close within the next few years, with an astronomical price tag for cleanup, 100 square miles of beautiful farmland that has been taken over during these Cold War years and destroyed for the foreseeable future. We're going to see essentially the fence remain around Jefferson Proving Ground when the Army leaves, mm-hmm. and we'll just have to hope that people never forget about it and never manage to wander onto the site because the unexploded ordnance can go off at any time and does.
It's also teeming with wildlife. Does this undercut the danger of the area and how people even look at it?
Well, you know, it's one of the sad ironies of the facility that that we've made a kind of eerie wildlife preserve out there in Indiana. Aside from being blown up once in a while, the deer and bobcats and many other types of wildlife actually do pretty well with the absence of human interference. It's not a wildlife refuge that we can visit unless we want to take our life in our hands, and it's not one that that most of us would be too happy to leave to future generations.
You visited military sites across the country only to discover that there were 19 suspected toxic sites 1 mile from your house. What are you doing about that?
In the course of working on the book, I was on my way out to a facility, and I was told by an Army public relations person, "Well, gee, why are you going all the way out there? You have a very similar problem in your own community." And at the time, I had been doing a lot of traveling, and I really took it upon myself to find out what I could about my local problem. I entered into a very lengthy investigation of my local site. It took me some 3 months to get a hold of some of the basic information about it. My local facility is an Army base that's also slated for closure. Mm-hmm. Having researched this around the country, I was in a somewhat of a unique position. And so I published some of the material locally about what I had discovered in my own community.
And did that have an effect?
It did have an effect. The Pentagon sent a delegation of some 12 people to my little town council to try and refute some of the findings that I'd published. Thankfully for my research, they were relatively unable to refute them. And in the course of that, I think our town council has really gotten to be a lot more vigilant about the cleanup. They applied for funds from the Army to allow the town to have a technical advisor to help us to understand the complex environmental documents that were being issued during the course of the cleanup. The Army denied us that money, but we've managed to raise the funds ourselves. We're going to pay for that consultant anyway, because it's the feeling of our representatives that without that kind of technical expertise, we won't be able to understand what's going on or to be well served during the cleanup.
Is this a model you think that can be used for the rest of the country?
Well, I hope so. Yeah, I think that that there's nothing to substitute for local involvement in the problem, and I think that that people who live near military bases, and that includes very many people, would be well served by getting more acquainted with the problem.
Seth Schulman, thank you for joining us on Fresh Air today.
Well, thank you. I'm glad for your interest in the topic.
Seth Schulman's book is called The Threat at Home, Confronting the Toxic Legacy of the U.S. Military. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moskowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. Performance artist Rodessa Jones was raised in a migrant farming family. She once worked as a stripper in a peep show, and she's taught aerobics to women in the San Francisco City Jail. The aerobics instruction turned into much more, an improvisational theater group for the women. It also inspired her theater piece, Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women. Coming up, a talk with Rodessa Jones about her life and her work. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new release by one of jazz's least known showmen, Hal Russell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Thailand, the king has now intervened to try and end the violence tied to anti-government protest. The violence broke out Sunday night during a demonstration against the appointment of a non-elected military leader as prime minister. Protesters defied a nighttime curfew and roamed throughout the capital. The government has closed three newspapers that have been strongly critical. The capital has been virtually closed with little traffic and boarded up shops. There have been a number of people killed and wounded, and more than 3,000 protesters have been arrested. But the prime minister now says they will be released. With Kazakhstan now following Ukraine and pledging to honor the START Treaty, Secretary of State James Baker hopes to get the other former Soviet republics' approval of what has become a four-nation agreement with the U.S. to cut stockpiles of long-range nuclear missiles, and that in turn could lead to even deeper cuts. Barry Schwide reports.
Unless there's a hitch, the Bush administration should be ready in a few weeks to ask the Senate to ratify the START Treaty. And there's no sign of a hitch with Russia or with Belarus. Approval would set in motion a 7-year procedure for withdrawing about 1/3 of the long-range missiles the U.S. and Soviet Union had deployed. And it would set the stage for negotiations for START II, even deeper cuts in the world's deadliest weapons. Over the 7 years, three nations would leave the nuclear club, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus, as they not only get rid of their long-range missiles, but join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty as nuclear-free nations. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
President Bush has declined to defend Vice President Dan Quayle's criticism of the television sitcom Murphy Brown, where the main character has a child out of wedlock. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The president is trying his best to put the Murphy Brown conundrum behind him. First, Vice President Quayle yesterday attacked the popular TV character for mocking the importance of fathers and calling her fictional pregnancy just another lifestyle choice. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater backed away from Quayle's remarks, saying that by choosing not to have an abortion, Murphy Brown demonstrated pro-life values which we think are good. President Bush said he didn't want to get into the details of a very popular television show.
I believe that children should have the benefit of being born into families with a mother and a father who will give them love and care and attention all their lives.
Mr. Bush added that he thinks children with two parents have the best shot at the American dream. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 4 points to close at 3,393.84, on volume of over 198 million shares. This is NPR News. Hours before Roger Coleman was slated to be executed in Virginia tonight, Governor Wilder said that Coleman had failed a lie detector test. Wilder said that he allowed the test at the request of Coleman's attorneys. Coleman was sentenced to death for the rape and stabbing death of his sister-in-law, crimes he has denied. Wilder's office has continued to get a flood of calls and letters in the case, even after clemency was denied. Since the U.S. Supreme Court allowed states to resume capital punishment in 1976, 13 people have been executed in Virginia. In Northern California, a judge has ruled that the state's university system cannot take a student's immigration status into account when deciding the amount of tuition a student will pay. This ruling came in a controversial case involving enrollment of undocumented students at 20 state college campuses. NPR's Isabel Alegria reports.
Today's ruling stems from a 1985 case challenging a California State University policy that classified undocumented students as non-residents for the purposes of setting tuition rates. A California resident pays approximately $1,000 per year in the state's college system, while non-residents pay $8,000. In his ruling, Superior Court Judge Ken Kawaichi agreed with opponents of the policy, who say it effectively bans hundreds of students from attending state universities, even though they may have lived in California and paid taxes for much of their lives. Today's ruling does not affect a related case in which an appeals court last year said the nine-campus University of California system could enforce a similar policy. In San Francisco, I'm Isabel Alegria reporting.
Landing rights for Yugoslav airplanes have been banned by the United States. This is in protest of Serbian action in the breakaway Republic of Bosnia. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A prison may seem like an unlikely place to teach aerobics. In 1987, Rodessa Jones was hired by the California Arts Council as an aerobics and movement instructor for women awaiting sentencing at the San Francisco City Jail. Jones soon found out that she'd never win them over with exercise alone, so she decided to turn aerobics into a stand-up routine. She started talking about herself as she went through the exercises. They listened, they moved a little, and after a couple of weeks, they started talking too. She's been working with women in and out of jail ever since, creating theater pieces. Her one-woman show, Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women, is based on the stories these women told her. I asked what it was like when she first arrived at the jail.
The seventh floor in the city jail in San Francisco is the holding tank, where you have women who haven't gone to trial yet. Women who are coming down off of drugs, coming down off of incredible domestic trauma, sometimes murder, sometimes the murder of their own children due to a cocaine phantasmagoric trip. So this was the gang, and I felt like I had been dropped into another world.
Were you scared at all about being there?
Scared? Nuts. I was more scared of the clinging doors and the people with the keys and the guns than I was the inmates themselves. But I was afraid of my inability. I thought, well, can I do anything here? Because there are women looking at me like, well, okay, what are you going to show us that we don't already know? Or who are you and how are you going to manipulate us? You know, so immediately I ran up against this kind of stone wall or soulless people, as someone said yesterday, a lot of deadness in the eyes. But I proceeded to the gym with about 40 women who were made to go with me. And I realized the very first day that, no, this isn't going to work. They're not interested in aerobics at all. But I proceeded to really talk about myself and my life and my struggles. And soon I developed a following. People would come to the gym to watch and listen to this crazy gym teacher, as they called me. And I started talking about their lives. I'd find out who was in jail for what. And there were lots of prostitutes at this particular time. So I started talking about empowerment through physicality. I'd look at somebody and say, you're a prostitute with that body? I said, now, girl, look, check this out. And these women got into me coming from a place where they were versus coming from some lofty place, telling them where they shouldn't be or how they should get out of this place. But I dealt with where they were. And it was about empowerment of women, even in jail. I mean, wherever you are, let's deal with what you got and see how we can make it better. So I had this little group that was learning all the routines that I was creating. And the older women were saying, well, do we have to move? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you have to move in a certain way, but you do get to talk. And I started devising games based on improvisational theater techniques.
One of the things that you've said about these women is what they seem to have in common, and what seemed to be the reason that many of them were in prison was because of love.
Love, yeah. We're all,
I mean, loving
women,
the wrong guy.
Yeah. But, you know, as women, I think we can all say, I mean, at some point in your life, there's a psychological prison that we're all in, because women who love too much, women who are constantly obsessed with love, well, in jail, you run into it, boom. It's like concentrated. Looking for love in all the wrong places, it's so real. It's just, you know, when you start to talk to people about, well, why are you here? First memory is usually a boy. When you're talking with women about their first offense, it usually has something to do with the man that they're involved with, or for the man. They, you know, either robbing, stealing, or even getting into drugs has a lot to do with wanting to keep that love, or what you think love is. Yes, it's it was definitely a part of the problem.
and it seems the way you describe it, it's a destructive love. I mean, it doesn't seem to have a lot to do with self-love. Yeah. It has to do with proving oneself to a guy. I mean, whether he's even a prostitute.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is that what makes you, me, us women who, quote, have sidestepped this incredible trap is that, well, I grew up during the 60s, so I have a certain politic, you know. And now my population, the women that I meet inside, they're young. Like I said, 19. They've been doing drugs since they were 9 years old. The only power they ever felt was that came with having somebody care, love about them, or having a certain kind of control, even sexual abuse, where you learn very early that if I let Uncle Frankie touch me, he'll give me $5. Then later, this man comes along, looks at you and goes, nice goods, convinces you that, oh, baby, you're so fine, and then you're convinced to go out on the street and sell your body because he loves you and because daddy needs the money, and this is how you prove you love daddy. And daddy also convinces you that there's nobody else but daddy.
Tell us about the title. I love the title. I think it's so kind of hearty. Big Butt Girls and Hard-Headed Women.
Well, when I first went in, the first week or so, sitting inside one morning, waiting for my group to get to be gathered, there was this incredible woman, about 6'3", 6'4", oh, maybe 200 pounds, but not flab, power, muscle, black like black velvet. And they were chaining her up to take her to prison. And I'm watching all of this, and in my little naive way, I said to her, she passed me, I said, take care of yourself, be safe. And she just turned and looked at me, and she said, girl, don't worry about it. And she went marching off, and the way she, from the back, the shoulders and the butt, and it was moving, and it's up and down, and it was like she had an army with her. She was taking her army with her. And, you know, Joni Mitchell, I think, has a great song called I'm a great cook and I'm sitting on my groceries. You know, it's like, you know, on the street. And in an African-American culture, you're constantly told about the possibility of your great past. You know, it's like as you walk by, you're groomed and as a girl coming into your own sexual reality, the hips, your body, the butt is a prideful thing to have a big butt. As I've grown older, the white dancers that I grew up with, now they look at me and they go, I'm going to the gym because I'm going to get buns like yours. And so the big butt was that. But the negative side was that my father would constantly say to us, sit your big butt down. You know, you ain't grown. Don't be so hard-headed. And sitting in jail, looking at these women, you know, and the diet is so bad. It's so bad that everybody is huge. Everybody gains a lot of weight. And what might have once been a buxom, round, voluptuous figure becomes this voluminous thing. And at the same time, the butts, people spend a lot of time expressing, saying things with their behinds, you know? I mean, things that they couldn't say to the guards, or if they were feeling a bit dangerous, that was a way to throw your butt.
My guest is performance artist Rodessa Jones. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with performance artist Rodessa Jones. She has a one-woman show, Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women, drawn from her experiences teaching aerobics at the San Francisco City Jail. Tell us a little bit about your family. You grew up in Florida. Your parents were migrant workers.
Yes.
So you obviously had a very mobile or transient childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Did you follow them, or did you also work on the farms with them?
Yeah, I grew up learning about work. Real work. I mean, the moving of the earth, the pulling and the straining, the lifting. At the same time, growing to have an incredible love for the earth, for my parents, because I work alongside them, understanding what it was to feed us. That was 12 of us.
Oh, and how old were you when you started working?
I started working. Well, you start working when you're about when you're five, you have to take care of the garden around the house. And if there are babies, you have to take care of babies. By the time you're 10, you're helping your mother cook the food that feeds the camp. And, of course, then you go on to the field with your parents. And you do the things like go back and pick up the potatoes that we're going to take home for us, learning to count the bags. Then by the time you're 12, 13, you actually have a row. You have a basket. You're out there pushing right along. And your money is important. This isn't fun pin money. This goes into the family pot. It is part of what feeds and sustains the family.
And you were one of 12 children.
Yes, I'm the eighth child.
Your family was poor,
yes.
no doubt about it.
Yes.
But you also have a brother that's a performance artist.
Guilty Jones.
Yourself.
Yes, dancer, choreographer.
Were your parents interested in the arts, and did they somehow then instill, did they even beyond the poverty of their lives, be able to instill this appreciation of art?
Well, you know,
in their children?
I think it stems from, you have to laugh to keep from crying. We spent a lot of time entertaining each other, telling stories. My father played mandolin. I have an uncle who, when he was a young man, he played in Ruth Brown's band. He's a banjo player. My mother was a gospel singer when she was much younger. And these things were just a part of the air. Because at the same time, you're taught that all colored folks sing and dance. So you don't want to do that. You want a basic, a good education so that you can go out and get a real job and don't repeat this life that my parents saw as very hard. Now, the other side of that was the romance of the migratory trek in the 40s and the 50s was that there were camps. So there were always talent shows. There were baseball games. There were barbecues. And so we grew up seeing these people who would work hard all week in the dirt. And they'd be, you know, scrubbing to make those few pennies. But on the weekend, you got another look at the dreams deferred. People who could really sing, people who could really tell jokes, the acrobats, the magicians, they were all there on the camps too, even the cooks. I mean, there were pie contests, that was the best barbecue sauce. So there was this constant feeling of being on, performing, and we were encouraged. I mean, we didn't have a television until 1958. And with 12 brothers and sisters, we wrote scripts, we did songs, we wrote music. And the other side of that was my mother was to raise 12 children. She was incredibly like a mama bear.
Yeah.
And we were fairly oppressed and repressed in a lot of ways. So when you grow up and you get away, you just explode.
You yeah. also worked for a while in a nude dancing club at Picarama. You were a peep show dancer.
Yes, I was.
Now, was this literally to make money?
Yes. Yes, I have.
Could you make good money?
I made, and this was 1978, 79. I could make $100 a night. Which wasn't bad because it was under the table. You were just handed the money every night. My daughter was going to a private school in Marin County. Her father had just stopped giving me any money, which was my impetus. I had to go out and get a job. I was getting $370-some a month from welfare. So at that time, it really, really padded my income. And yes, I did it and kept the kept my welfare checked as well. Yeah.
Did you have any embarrassment about being naked? I assume most of the men in the most people in the club were men, although it was run by lesbians. Is that
yes,
right?
Yeah,
that's a great twist, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it was quite eye opening for me. It inspired me to make a performance. I thought everything was so the opposite of what we'd been raised to believe it was. It was very boring work.
Is there anything sexual about it for you as a performer in a nude club?
It's empowering when you realize that men will pay to look at a naked woman. And I was endowed with a great body, tight tush, great long legs, you know. But sexual in the sense of feeling female-ish or a woman on a certain level, no. But that was power and being, it was more like being a deity or a goddess. Those are the kinds of images I would play with, you know, sitting. Because half of the job was that you sat in a glass booth and men would put coins in and the window would open and they'd get to talk to you behind this glass.
Hmm.
And
so you would sort of come on with sort of velvety, seductive words?
Well, you didn't do anything because most men don't have any idea what the, you know, I mean, that was rare. It was very rare and few times when somebody would come along and that was an erotic exchange or... Hmm. Eroticism in the artistic or intellectual way that we know it, the Kama Sutra, that wasn't there. There's a lot of woman hating in the world, you know. And the men who frequent these places really hate women.
And the women that work there, do they really hate men? I mean, is this a way of taunting men?
I think the lesbians or the women who sort of knew why they were there for the money could hate men. But I think women were far more generous. I think even the lesbians that worked there, it would have been too much to hate them. Taunting them, teasing them was another thing, you know. I mean, because it's really strange when we're raised in a society to believe that men are supposed to be running the world when, you know, and all you gotta do is drop your trowel and you got these people drooling all over glass windows. I mean, it's like for lots of dollars. I mean, really. And a lot of men, this was their sex life. I mean, something's wrong here.
Yeah. We unfortunately just have about a minute left, but I'm wondering whether this work at a nude club helped you as a performance artist.
Yes.
In terms of your effect on an audience.
Oh, yes. I mean, and on top of that, it was like the racism that I ran into. Even as a nude woman, all of a sudden it was like, wait a minute, what's going on here when we can't all even be equal when we have our clothes off? I mean, I was 28, 29 years old. I was a great-looking woman, and still there would be men who would say, you know, you black bee this, and, you know, I don't want to look at you. And I knew that I was a hot-looking girl. And all of a sudden this was happening, and even amongst the women, there was sometimes this kind of racist competition, you know, assuming if I'm blonde, of course I'm the hottest one here. And here we all are stuck in this really tawdry, gross, stuck, sick little place, groveling around like a bunch of guppies or something, and these people, we're going to compete with each other, and there's going to be racist overtones even there. That was, for me, a place to start writing down what is going on? What do men and women expect from each other?
Performance artist Rodessa Jones will perform her one-woman show, Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women, in Boston on June 5th, 6th, and 7th. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Robert. What stories from Thailand?
Well, we'll be hearing about the King of Thailand summoning the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition, who was until today in jail, to meet with him, kneel before him, as they did according to tradition. And he urged them now to cooperate, talk face-to-face, and change the constitution of Thailand so that the Prime Minister should be an elected politician, not a general. We'll see whether that has the effect, those actions of the king, in stopping the violence. Also today, we'll be hearing about the intersection of 14th and U Streets in Washington. It used to be a center of black cultural life here until integration and the riots.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album on the ECM label. ECM is the home of Keith Jarrett's solo piano recitals, icy Scandinavian saxophones, and other refined and restful music. But once in a while, they make an exception.
Tell a jazz fan that Hal Russell's new album is on the ECM label, and they'll probably say, yeah, so, who's Hal Russell? The ones who do know will say, no, there must be some mistake. '66-year-old Hal Russell's, for want of a better term, avant-garde multi-instrumentalist from Chicago. On his ECM album, The Finnish-Swiss Tour, he plays drums, vibes, trumpet, and tenor and soprano saxophones. Each member of his five-piece NRG ensemble plays at least three instruments, from vibes to electric guitar to didgeridoo. Chicago's black collective, the AACM, wrote the book on avant-garde jazz multi-instrumentalism, but Russell's not aligned with that or any other movement. He's in the great tradition of American loners like Charles Ives, Harry Parch, and Ezra Pound. With his white beard and weathered but imposing appearance, he even looks like those guys. But Russell's also a consummate showman. On stage, he'll sing through a megaphone as a sideman blows bubbles at him out of a toy sax. Or he'll don a pair of wraparound shades for a trumpet feature that sounds like a parody of 1970s Miles Davis. Russell's onstage antics used to puzzle me. I couldn't reconcile his genial humor and industrial strength music. But after seeing him play a few times last year, including a strange album release party in East Berlin, all the peculiar details suddenly made sense. The trumpets muted by hand, the tributes to Dorothy L'Amour, Fred Astaire, and bandleader Jimmy Lunsford, the singing through a megaphone, and Steve Hunt's flashy drum solos. If I'm right, Russell's running a crackpot version of a 1930s dance band. All the instrument switching conveys the illusion of a larger group. Those old bands always use the popular rhythms of the day, the way the ruthless NRG rhythm section echoes punk and throb metal. And Russell's tune, Raining Violets, harps on a riff more than Glenn Miller's In the Mood did. Obviously, how Russell delights in the clunky and the weird. But sometimes his music is surprisingly tender, in its own ungainly way. Of course, every dance band needs a change of pace. Dance of the Spider People is as close to the atmospheric ECM sound as these guys get. To be honest, no album can convey the splendor of seeing Hal Russell live. His visual shticks and crotchety stage manner are really funny. But the bitter truth is, if you don't live in Chicago, you won't have many opportunities to see Russell. In that case, his album The Finnish Swiss Tour makes a sweet substitute.
Kevin Whitehead is a freelance writer based in New York. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller with Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, Naomi Person, and Sue Spolin. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, Nigerian writer Ben Okri. He won Britain's prestigious Booker Prize for his novel, The Famished Road, about growing up in a poor African village. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.